Oh, that's right, to Texas.
Oh, uh-oh. That was a...
Testing, testing.
Okay, that's Walter's.
We have to do the intro, I guess. Mm-hmm. We're both...
God, I can't even hear us. There we go. We're both drinking... What is that? That's not beer, is it?
Oh, gosh, no. It's a...
Oh, ginger beer.
It's a ginger brew.
Yeah. I'm so drinking watermelon lemonade. He's drinking ginger brew. And we're eating junk food, including...
corn nuts, beef jerky, and...
Yeah.
Kettle chips.
Yeah, it's guy food.
Crinkle cuts.
Mm. You know what's funny? I had a shitty day for like the last 3 or 4 hours, and then when I walked in here, everything was fine.
See? You should do Radio Mysterio so every Sunday.
I was feeling...
Because it makes you feel better.
I guess it does. I went to the last Dodger game of the season today.
Oh, and is that why there was fireworks?
Were there fireworks?
Well, I just saw one big
burst. No, that's just people lighting up fireworks.
No, this was a big professional-sized burst.
The game was over at 4.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, yeah, there was a guy sitting next to me. You know those people that sit next to you at things, and apparently they paid for half of your seat, too?
Like on the airplane.
Yeah, with his arm like over here, and the whole time I'm leaning. And if I have to lean that way for like 20 minutes, my back starts to hurt because I'm not sitting straight. So I push back, and then he doesn't care. Oh, and then the capper was, he was spitting out sunflower seeds. He spit one of them on my leg. And he spilled beer at my feet. And when I left my seat, he started spitting the seeds in front of my seat. I come back, I'm like, what the fuck?
At what point did you say anything to him?
When he spit on my leg, I just looked at him. And I said, really? And he said, oh, sorry, dude. Oh, sorry.
Jeez.
Oh,
a grown man that says dude.
Yeah.
And as a serious part of his vocabulary.
Yeah. Now, I think he might have said bro, which is even worse.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is worse.
Don't you bro me. I'm not your fucking bro. Bro.
Of course, that's what you get for hanging out in places like Dodger Stadium.
I guess so. I'm not a fan of some of the fans. Well, I just want a ton of money so I can sit in a private place and not be bothered by
my anybody. Football team won a game today that they should not have won.
Yeah, but your baseball team is going to the playoffs.
And you know why? Would you like? I can tell you exactly why the Orioles have had a hot season. You know why?
Because you're rooting for them. I don't know.
Because I'm ignoring them. Those bastards, whenever I root for them,
yeah,
they choke well before the All-Star break. So I'm just crossing my fingers and keeping my mouth shut.
Yeah, just don't even talk about it anymore. It'll be the Dodgers and the Orioles. That'd be a weird one.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about...
Radio Mysterioso.
Wait, it's funny. Here's one I just had in the car. And it's almost appropriate. Wait, will this work? Whoops. A show that scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture.
This just came up on shuffle
in
my car.
We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter, We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity.
For like the next magic hour,
sit
was...
quietly and we will control
I
all that you see and
hear. I always preferred this over the Twilight Zone.
We repeat, there is nothing
I
wrong
did when I was
with
younger.
Your television set.
No, when I got older, I preferred
you
the Twilight
are
Zone.
About to participate in a great
no,
adventure.
I don't prefer, but I liked it as much.
You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to
Radio Mysterioso.
Limits.
Walter's back after
and
a hiatus of a huh.
And front.
Yes, after a hiatus of a few...
All summer, actually.
Couple of months. A few months, yeah.
It's a few months because I was here after Empire of the Wheel 3 came out, right?
Yeah. How's that one doing?
Really good. Really well, I should say.
Somebody put up a very long rebuttal to that on the Radio Mysterioso site, which I approved like 2 or 3 weeks ago. Have you seen it?
I guess I haven't. A long rebuttal, how so?
Just, you know, all your ideas are full of crap, and here's why.
Oh, well.
You might have to answer that.
I look forward to seeing that. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
How they can be all entirely full of crap. Must be one of the must be one of your listeners that, that just don't like me. They are out there. I think there's a critical mass that don't like me.
It's not a mass that has become critical. It's a mass of people that are critical.
No, I think there's a fair chunk of your listeners that... Wait, I'm not going to eat the crunchy things while I'm talking. I think there's a fair number
I
of
was.
Your listeners who...
Here, you have the beef jerky.
Who don't like me. You know,
They don't like you?
Yeah, here's the thing, Greg. We live in a
damn
society...
Damn that Walter, damn
we live
him.
In a society where if some guy isn't the kind of guy you want to hang out with and have a beer with, or in some people's cases, smoke a doob, which they know I'll never do, they don't like anything you do. I think that's the kind of society we live in. So that said, I think there's a lot of people out there in the podcast audience who are of that ilk. That there's something about me personally that they don't like, so they probably don't like my stuff. Now that said, there could also be people who like me that just have a beef with a particular claim I make. That's
it's all over the map.
Yeah, it's all over the map.
It takes all kinds.
Yeah, but I will. I'm anxious to see this. Maybe during a break we can pull up the page and I can take a read on it. Because I'm about ready to throw some more stuff out there that they'll probably hate.
So this is probably unofficially or so the fifth Empire of the Wheel book?
Unofficially this would be the...
sixth?
If you count the time travel novel.
I do count the time travel book because that's my favorite one.
Damn,
see
the
you
novel.
In time.
Not the nonfiction, the fake one.
It's because it is a story, it is told as a story, and I am spoon-fed very nicely little bits of the ideas wrapped up in a nice story.
Oh, okay.
That's why I like that book.
Well, I'm glad you like it. I mean, you can like it for whatever reason you... I
think it'd make a great movie.
People can... You hear that, Hollywood? Any producers listening out there? He's not the only one who said this. Read the damn book. And don't rip it off. Yes. The Secret Missions is the sixth book that is a product of all this research that began with digging into the ley lines at Disneyland and then led to other things. And it's actually the last official book of the Empire of the Wheel era. I'm now focusing for the next year solidly on writing fiction, and I'm having a great... I haven't enjoyed writing fiction so much in some years now, and I'm really digging into it. And I'm getting good reviews on the first, you know... But that's something I'll talk about later. But, Secret Missions, The Hidden Legacy of Old California...
Yes, I was going to... That is the new one.
Kind of... it was a book... It is a book that the data had been coming to me since 2007. Mm-hmm. Late 2007, early 2008. And I just kept putting it aside. I knew I had to get to it at some point.
We were talking about it when we went to the Cabrillo Monument.
Yeah. So I had to... once I got Empire of the Wheel 3 done and out there... that load of crap. I decided, you know what? I think I'm just going to go ahead and knock out this Cabrillo book because I have other things that are going on that I need to get to. You okay?
Yeah. Just drowning.
So I got to it. It was kind of an... I didn't... When I finished EOW 3, I didn't know I was going to just jump on this book and write it. So it was a pretty quickly put together book.
Yeah, because you already had all the notes.
Yeah. I just had to do a little bit of research to fill in some holes.
I started reading it, and Sigrid was next to me, and I was going, huh? What? She goes, what's your first question? You're going to Walter going to be, what the hell?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty simple, the whole thing, actually.
When you get, yeah, the through line of it is very simple. Yeah. Do you want to say what it is?
Basically, here's what we got. The book, I see.
I've read about a little over 75%
yeah.
of it.
The book, to me, is presenting a bigger picture in the three elements, okay? You have the element of a lost relic.
Yeah.
A legitimate known item in history that was lost and unaccounted for and of great interest to the people searching for it. You have the whole issue, which is popular in recent years, of the Knights Templar in the Americas. And you have this complete true mystery of Juan Cabrillo, the explorer who was credited with being the first European to explore what's called Alta or Upper California, everything yep. north of Baja.
Yep.
And what this book does is looks at each one of those mysteries as separate elements, and then also how it's possible that they all tied together. Chronologically, you had the Knights Templar establishing itself in the Americas, and the evidence to support that theory. And then you have the relic when it needed to be, according to my theory, when it needed to be secreted away. Being brought to the Americas, specifically to North America. And then you have Juan Cabrillo's role in which the relic plays a part. And this book is similar to Empire of the Wheel 2 in that I go out there and propose my theory on answering some of the questions about a historical figure amid some more wilder things.
I hope you can't hear that.
I can hear it. No, I hope they can hear it. I don't know.
I don't think the mics pick it up. There's a ceiling fan that's just about to fall apart. Anyway.
It'd be fun if there was just one blade on it.
That'd be even better.
Yeah. So there's kind of the overview of the book, and you know, that kind of leads into a discussion of the details, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we could start sort of in a chronological beginning with something that's very interesting to me and something I might have disagreements with you on because I know something about a little bit. We'll get into that in a minute, but which you will either disabuse me of or you'll say, huh. What you found, which should be interesting to everybody, what's the earliest evidence for anybody that's not, wasn't here to begin with, you know, came either from China or to any of the Americas, north or south? Vikings, Romans, Chinese, Pacific Islanders, anyone.
Well, that...
And what's that based on?
That's a big question.
It's huge. I mean, it's hard to tell, I think.
Yeah, that's been very popular in recent years.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I don't think anybody owns that topic, but a lot of people adventured there long before I did.
Oh, yeah, it's been going on since.
Yeah, the evidence I present is the forever. Stuff you've heard about. But the problem is mainstream science or mainstream history, they throw the... Like you said, the person on the thing said, oh, all your stuff's bullcrap. The mainstreamers throw the bullcrap penalty flag, into the mix. So therefore, everything presented is indeed considered controversial. I do point out that certain things like the, I think it's the Newport Tower.
Yeah, it's the one in Massachusetts.
Or Rhode Island. Yeah, I wrote the book. It's been a while since I looked at the book, and I've been writing other things. I apologize. The Newport Tower, you know, I point out that That was not a Templar construction. In fact, that's the documented the document trail is a better way to put it. Explains who built that and when and why. So, you know, whenever you see this on TV, oh, the Newport Tower, it could be. No, it was not a Templar construction. One of the arguments, for example, about the Westford Knight, which is in Westford, Massachusetts. Many of you
probably, that was one of my questions.
The stone that has the carved effigy of the knight with the shield and the sword, again, accused of being very controversial. One of the claims of a particular skeptic, for example, is that Westford is too far inland for the Templars to have gone. And in my book, I point out exactly why that is the most ridiculous accusation and dismissal of the Westford Knight possibly being, you know, a relic associated with Templar explorers, because there were rivers and other waterways. Westford is west of Boston, which I believe is a harbor city, and and there is a major river in the area that existed, has existed for ages, that it certainly existed at the time that the Templars allegedly came through, and they could easily have gone to what is today Westford. So the book points out the details.
There's tons of stuff around the United States that apparently predates that are pre-Columbian and not Native American.
Right, exactly. And it just all depends on where you stand with diffusionism and, you know, what your personal position is. Remember, I don't try to convince anybody of a damn thing. I present stuff. I say, hey, this is what I think. This is what's possible. Here's the evidence. You decide. You conclude for yourself. And that's where I get a lot of criticism, because people just want you to come out and say, this is the way it is. And even if they're not going to believe you and they want to tear you down.
In the speculative fiction and worked all this in, nobody would care, right?
Well, right, but then you got to think up a plot, and then you got to do, you know, I wanted to get this stuff out. Let me put it this way. I have my reasons for writing these books that aren't the conventional, look how clever I am, look at my theory, I want to sell books. Okay, now, I enjoy the hell out of selling books.
Yes.
I like the idea that there are people, and I do have a readership. For the last year or so, my books have been solid. And those people, I love them dearly, whoever they are, that have been buying the books solidly month after month after month for about the last year and a half.
Yeah, we've discussed this before.
It's finding an audience.
Yeah, that you find people that like it or want to discuss it with you intelligently. Yeah. That's icing on the cake.
Yeah, exactly. But I'll tell you, there is another reason that, you know, that I wrote these books, that it's more personal and it has more to do with the things I don't talk about publicly that, you know, have gone on in the background with all this stuff.
Right.
So, you know, whatever. I'll rebut people who tell me I'm full of crap, but I don't lose sleep over it. But anyway, with this book, especially, and with others, what I try to do is, you know, admit where something, for instance, when I'm arguing the Templar case, I think I point to things where I say, well, that probably wasn't, you know, a Templar thing, even though it's popular to think it was, like in the case of the Newport Tower. But then I point to other things that get refuted, and I say, well, like the Westford Knight effigy, and I say, well, they sure as hell could have, in a small boat, you know, gone from the harbor in no time into the Westford area. So,
yeah.
You know, that's what I try to do. I also did this where the reputation of the Spanish conquistadors is concerned. You know, I didn't even know myself till researching this book that this whole idea that that Spain sent these guys over there and just, rape and pillage and murder the Indians and then, you know, all the natives and we don't care. It was the complete opposite. The crown and the people in charge of these explorations and sending these explorers out there, they were sent under very specific orders, written down in the official royal-approved documents, to treat the natives with respect, with kindness, and to not rile them up. And when conquistadors would do the opposite, when they would disrespect him, when they would make, you know, it, they were told that if they were attacked by hostile natives to defend themselves.
Yes.
Right? But when conquistadors would go out there and just slaughter them and, you know, act like an a-hole to the natives, the crown would have them brought up on charges.
Which and natives? Everybody?
Any natives that they encountered here in the Americas. They were specifically told, you know, establish trade with them, treat them with respect. Do not. Certain conquistadors were sentenced to death for atrocities committed on the Native Americans. And you never hear that in movies. You never hear that on TV. You don't hear that in school because it's not popular. It's not the popular politics. And I won't get into a big discussion there. But
so the Pueblo Revolt in New Mexico in the 16... I can't remember what it was. Was that just because there were a bunch of misinformed Native Americans that just hated the Spanish?
What incident are you referring to?
Let me look it up. There was a revolt of every single tribe, well, all the ones that had large populations in New Mexico during the Spanish colonial period, and it was actually successful. It kicked the Spaniards out for about 10 years.
No, notice I didn't say that atrocities didn't happen, nor do I claim in the book that they
didn't.
What I am saying is that it was not officially sanctioned, and these guys were punished. Coronado was financially ruined.
The thing is that
he was a prick.
Yeah. We can find many evidences all throughout history of people not following orders when they didn't think anybody was looking or when the leader
said go ahead.
But
most of the conquistadors actually did.
The funny thing is, what I wanted to bring up was the Cabeza de Vaca stuff, because you didn't talk too much about it, and I'm obsessed with that story.
And that's because I think it's talked a lot of people. There's a lot written about it elsewhere.
Yes.
And it didn't have the specific bearing on what I was doing, but it is a very fascinating episode in that.
When you read it, if you read the translation of it, there's a few of them. There's he was probably the first to see any, you know, the first non-Native American that these people had seen for a lot of the people he met, probably most of them, except the ones in Florida they'd already seen. They went from, you know what happened. They went from Florida. They went across Florida. A bunch of them died. Indians killed a bunch of them. There was disease. Out of like 400 people, I think 4 survived. And he came back and wrote this up for the king. And he actually said in the things like, these are all people. They're God's children. We should not screw with them. We should not treat them badly. And that was the first report, I think, one of the first official reports given to the king.
And that was reflected in the instructions. Remember, I was writing about...
And not a lot of them were nice to him. Some were nice and some were horrible.
That's right.
Not everybody was nice to him.
I'll tell you, I got some comments about the Iroquois nations, okay? But that's later down the road. But,
okay.
Here's the thing. My book focuses on the late 15th and early 16th centuries, okay?
Yep.
And as you had mentioned, you'd brought up a 17th century revolt. Yeah, by the time, the more you had people interacting, you know, from Europe to the Americas with time, we all know there was misbehavior. But honestly, early on, Spain sent these guys over there with the instructions
1680.
To not do these things, to not commit these atrocities. And you had Pizarro's brother.
There was also the, let's convert
Coronado.
Them to our religion, and a lot of the tribes like, screw you guys.
Yeah.
We're kind of tired of it.
Well, yeah, and then that's the other... That could be another book in itself. You know, certain Vatican agendas.
Anyway.
So, yeah. So that's an interesting aspect of the book that the book gets into. It gets into De Soto, Coronado, Eusebius Kino, who is a very interesting figure, I found.
Yeah, you want to talk about him for a little bit? Because he's basically he's all over the place in Arizona, especially in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only place I really think of in the Southwest where people actually
where he was known to be. I suspect that he made it to Phoenix. But for some reason, this was not documented. And it probably had to do with, you got to remember.
I don't know, he went all over the Southwest, even possibly to California. Southern.
Yeah, but the record is that he didn't make it to Phoenix proper.
Oh, okay.
You got to remember, clandestine activity, you know, certainly didn't begin with the 20th century. And you know that. I know that well. But sometimes people forget that. And I would argue that Eusebius Kino was one of many who didn't always write about or didn't publicly display every little thing he did, every little thing he was instructed to do. And I would argue that, you know, maybe his forays into Phoenix would have been one of those more clandestine things. If they were indeed especially looking for sites of telluric current. Or
did they know about that?
Knights Templar sites.
How was this mapped when nobody knew what things looked like or how to follow? Or
well, they knew how to do it, probably most likely with instruments. I go into in the Empire of the Wheel books. I explain how and why this would have been known prior to the 1850s, when it's been documented that telluric current was known. Okay. So the Empire of the Wheel books go into that extensively enough to explain why these guys in the 15th and 16th centuries would have known about it. It was part of that lost technology information that, I mean, come on, there's evidence that the Vatican had their hands on since the fall of the Library of Alexandria. And who was Kino working for? Father Eusebius Kino was a priest. So,
who was originally German?
German. Indeed.
What was he doing in New Spain? Or something that was part of the territory?
Actually, the book explains that he went to New Spain to argue for a commission to come to the New World. He really, really wanted to get to the New World. Real badly. So he went to Spain to argue, a commission for that Spain or the... I think he argued it in Spain and the Vatican, of course, his masters at the Vatican, and then he got the commission to come to the New World, and the rest is, you know, documented history. But he was an astronomer. He was one of these guys who sounded, you know, kind of in the vein of a, if not John Dee, certainly a man who probably had his hands on some ancient knowledge, if we suppose that the whole... Yeah, remember, I'm coming from a position, I'm somebody who I don't believe in the linear theory where we started out as apes and trees and or emerged from caves and, you know, we are the most technologically advanced civilization the world has ever known. I don't buy that.
Why did you throw that out, Walter? Not that I disagree with you.
Because Kino would have been one of these guys with his background... who would have had an interest in and probably had his hands on that kind of information as a priest, you know, working under the Vatican. So that's the position I'm coming from.
Well, I'm just trying to take us down a short divergence about what is a secret history or a different history and why people should consider it. Because that's kind of the background of why you would consider reading your book.
Yes, indeed.
You know, what are people missing, and why should they look? Apart from the obvious fact that people look at things in different ways and make things work in different ways that we have no idea of or we have forgotten.
Most people shouldn't even bother looking at this idea and considering these things because, quite frankly...
People listening to the show should.
People listening to the show will. Yes. The should doesn't even come into it. They
probably already have.
Yeah. Well, some of them. But because these things really have bearing on very few people's lives. I mean, you can go through your life without ever knowing anything about any of the evidence for this.
Yeah, you can go through your life without eating very nice food either, but it makes life a lot more interesting and fun.
Doesn't it now?
Yes.
See, but that this is my position of I ain't trying to convince anybody to do anything. You know, all I'll when you here's the deal. When
why is it interesting to you?
When you look Why is it interesting to me?
Yeah.
Because to me, certain conclusions or suspicions become self-evident. The more you really, when you give an honest look to the evidence that's there, when you give some honest analysis and you're honest with yourself, if you still come away thinking it's all bullshit, then we have nothing to discuss because you're to some degree in denial. Just because you're just stubbornly wanting to, you know.
What's a huge one that's like, why are you so stupid, kind of? And maybe not even in your book, but just something everybody would know about.
Well, the linguistic evidence is one. There's linguistic evidence between the Americas and the Pyrenees, specifically the Basque people. The uses of X and other letters in the language, which... not used anywhere else by any, but yet there it was allegedly independently in the Americas, and there it was in the Pyrenees region with the Basques. And here's the thing. The Basques are suspected, well, they are known to be one of the oldest cultures on Earth, okay? And some suspect that they might have been a colony of whatever. Now, listen carefully to what I'm going to say. A colony of whatever Atlantis actually was.
I've never heard this one.
Okay. And, there's a book, I believe it's Atlantis in Spain, that you should check out. It's David publishes it, Adventures Unlimited Press. And it's just one book that talks about that. But when you look at the linguistic evidence between the Basques and the ancient Mexicans, the Aztecs, when you look at the yam, the sweet potato, which exists in South America and the South Pacific Islands, and the evidence that's presented for that that pretty much is convincing to me that it was carried over one direction or the other across the seas. Just the fact that Thor Heyerdahl accomplished what he did with Kon-Tiki proved, was it a bitch? Was it going to sink eventually? Yeah, but it proved it could be done.
Yeah.
Those are just, you know, three examples of the you know, so that argues for diffusionism as opposed to isolationism. So if you had diffusionism.
The coca and the
yes, the coca leaf in the found
and
in the
tobacco
mummies. Yes,
and mummies.
Exactly,
and
the tobacco
in many of them.
Yeah, German scientists discovered that in the 90s, I believe.
Yeah,
and
it was in the hair and stuff.
Oh, in the blood and the bones and the hair. I mean,
yeah.
it wasn't like it was there.
It was environmental after the fact.
Right. Yeah. Now, as far as the advanced technology idea goes. I'll tell you, there's one place I've been on this planet that I went to with David Childress back in 2003, before it started appearing on a lot of TV shows and stuff. David dragged myself and Doug Nason and another guy,
kicking and screaming.
Great guy, I can't think of his name right now, excuse me, and we were at Tiahuanaco, and he said, guys, come over here, I'm going to bring the group over here in a minute, but come over here and tell me what you think. And so... you know, we walked over there, and it was Puma Punku. And when you look at the blocks and stone,
it's the
cut stones that are. I'm telling you, it was machined. All right, I'm not even going to get into a discussion with anybody over natives in loincloths using wet strings and copper wires pulling them back and forth. I mean, or you know, the discovering acid. When you look at the lines on these things, and not just on TV or online, when you are there. And you get a feel for the place, and you look around. I mean, come on. David asked me, this was in 2003. David asked me, what do you think this is? And I said, this looks like, these blocks here look like a foundation for machinery, as if, like when you go to a paper mill or anywhere where there's giant, heavy machinery.
Something's anchored to the ground. So that it doesn't move around when it's doing its work.
Yeah, and I said, it looks like the machinery is gone, of course, but here's the foundation. And he just kind of smiled, and after I said that, he goes, well... It so happens, and this is the first time I'd heard this legend, that the legend here is that the advanced race, you know, they refer to them as giants, had built this city with this amazing machinery, and when there was going to be a cataclysm, they took their machinery and left everything else behind. And I was stunned. you know. And when you see it firsthand, and that's just one example, but it's really the preponderance of the available evidence when you look at it. I mean, look at the Cremo and Thompson book. And yes, people are probably rolling their eyes right now. Oh, Cremo and Thompson. Let me tell you, Cremo and Thompson, in their thick version of their book, Forbidden Archaeology, there must be 50 pages in there where they print every insulting criticism, every spit of venom that was leveled at them by skeptical science and angry science and mainstream science. It's hilarious to read this stuff, these professionals. And they present it in the very beginning of their book. But people that are interested in what I'm saying, you know, that's just one example. That book, and it's full of them.
Yeah.
Out-of-place objects, they're called.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's, yeah, out-of-place objects, out-of-place artifacts. Yeah, I think that was coined by Fort, actually.
Mm. Mr. Fort.
Yeah. So, and there's whole books of them, actually. By the descendant of Fort, probably, who's William Corliss, his source books. If you can find those, they're amazing. Basically, it's like as if you took Charles Fort and just made him into this nerdy guy that didn't have this, you know, he doesn't really, well, I guess he does have theories, but he pretty much sticks to, this is from Scientific American from 1978, you know. Here's an article about, you know, the spark plug, you know, the COSO spark plugs from the, and they're all from, you know, New York Times. They're not from, like, Weekly World News. They're all from, like, these reputable.
Right. Yeah.
Thousands of pages of them.
Well, the stuff is out there. And like I said, if you give it an honest consideration and you still come away thinking it's all bullshit, then really there's nothing to discuss because you're just the kind of person.
Yeah, you should at least be interested.
Yeah. So that's kind of the background where I'm coming from, and that helps explain my opinion regarding the relic that the book focuses on.
Yes, I got further in the book and read about the tarnished but easily cleaned relic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to discuss that?
Oh, absolutely. The book's out there. Yeah. Here's the thing. Let me lead into it.
Because some people are like, I don't want to talk about that. You have to read the book. It's like, you know what? Anybody that has a good book, they'll just say, look, this is what the book's about. This is the conclusion I came to. Read it and see if you agree with me.
The book has been out for a month now.
Yeah.
This is just the first interview I've done.
It seems like it's only been
The book's been out 3 weeks. Yeah. Wow, I've written a novel in that time. Or I should say I've finished the final draft and published a novel.
You are turning into Ed Wood, man. You're just cranking them out.
Redfern?
No, Ed Wood.
Oh, that too, yeah.
Maybe well, somewhere between Redfern and Ed Wood.
Well, I've kind of put the films on hold for a while, but
did you go to Lovecraft Festival?
No, we did not.
Sigrid went. She said she saw a couple of films she liked.
Really?
On Friday she went.
Oh, I'll have to talk to her about that to find out, you know, because this is the year we sat out this year because stuff. But where I'm coming from, the relic, yes. We're back to the relic.
Das Relic.
It's not the Grail. It's not the Lost Ark of the Covenant. Although I present an interesting little tie-in, what I think the Ark could have been relative to this mystery.
I don't remember. I remember you mentioning it, but I don't remember what you said about it, except for the fact that of it being reported as some source of power or a battery.
A battery.
Yeah,
we're
essentially actually.
Essentially, a battery to. Now, here's the thing.
A quick discharge, high voltage battery.
Now,
a capacitor.
There's evidence that I did not, let me rephrase. Yeah, there's threads of evidence that I did not put in the book because the nature of that evidence is, you know, it served only to lead me to evidence that is in the book. Okay, but since 2007, I had distinct pointers to the lost sword of Joan of Arc. And I was keeping my mouth shut. I really kept that to myself.
I remember we saw that stat. That's what I referred to Cabrillo. You were like, look at that sword. What's that big sword? And this was before you even wrote, I think, maybe even the first book.
Yeah, it was before I wrote the first book. Yeah. And here's the thing. He didn't carry a big sword like that.
Well, would it be normally put on there because it's part of being a soldier and it's symbolic?
It goes even further than that, which I didn't go into in the book because I decided not to, because that might be and some information I didn't want to disclose, but it has more to do with, if you remember, if you look, let's look at the Cabrillo statue, the Cabrillo Monument. You guys can look it up online in San Diego, Point Loma, exactly. Basically, he's standing on a pedestal with this big, giant broadsword. Ha-ha.
Is it in front of him or to his side?
It's to—it's in front to his side. He's kind of facing one direction, so it's in.
Is he facing
it's in
south?
Front of him. Huh?
I think he's facing south, isn't he?
No, I thought he's facing north. Good question. Unless
the
I'm
point
looking
comes
at it
down, and I thought he was looking out from the point. Yeah. And the point is south.
This has to do with anyway. He might be looking into town. Yeah, actually. Well, but here's the thing: there's the big sword, and the point is down. And it's very reminiscent of the sword in the stone, although the sword, his sword is not embedded in the stone.
How
but
is
if
it
you
reminiscent?
Look at the pedestal as a stone and the sword on top of it, it's very similar to the whole sword in the stone symbolism, only the sword is not embedded or not buried, as later the book argues about Juan Cabrillo himself, which I will get into.
There must be thousands of statues of people with swords holding them that aren't embedded in stone because it's a pedestal.
Okay. There are thousands.
Ahead.
You're right.
Go ahead.
You're right. There are thousands. That's the beauty of... here's the thing. There must be thousands of those like that, but there's only one on that spot in the likeness of that man. There's only one that I found in his likeness on a spot like that. So therein lies the huge difference.
I don't see the difference. Go ahead.
Meaning well, the
it's
fact an, that
it's iconography the, to have the, a sword the, with you, and if you carve it out of stone, you can't have it sitting on top of the stone because you'll break it. You have to have it like at least.
You're
touching
being you're being too literal.
Okay.
You're not seeing the forest for the trees.
I'm saying it's similar to many other statues that have no significance whatsoever, except for their portrait of somebody.
And it is similar to very many other statues.
Okay, go ahead.
This is a statue of Juan Cabrillo on Point Loma.
Yeah.
And when you read that book and my other books, you get the significance of that. And the significance is what makes all the difference. See? Where was I?
You said it was similar to a more famous sword, and I was asking you, how is it similar?
The sword in the stone symbology. You have the sword in the stone at Disneyland. The readers of Latitude 33 will know well that when they moved the carousel, I argue, off of the intersection of the three ley lines, they put the sword in the stone right on that spot. And readers of Secret Missions will learn that what the sword of Joan of Arc had to do with Excalibur, the sword in the stone of Arthur. Essentially, the sword of Joan of Arc had a lot of similarities to the description of Excalibur. And also,
this I found incredibly interesting.
The sword of Charles Martel. The Frankish king, or I'm sorry, Frankish leader. He wasn't a king. He was a prince.
Yeah.
Who defeated the Muslim army at Tours. And it's a really great story if you're into military history and such. Go ahead. I've kind of lost. I got to take a sip of water. My throat's getting dry.
Well, you caught me right in the middle of eating corn nuts that you have thoughtfully brought in. No, you started this, and what you were heading towards was, and I think you were heading towards, was what are the similarities between a possibly apocryphal, mythical sword in the stone and one that was actually used by two different people?
No. What I was saying was there's something I did not get into in the book that has to do with sword in the stone. What I was leading to, this is what it was now. There is sword in the stone symbology that is used in certain places.
Right.
I did not get into this in the book, and I won't. I won't get into it here in depth. And the Juan Cabrillo statue is one of these items. The sword in the stone at Disneyland is one of these items, and they have to do with telluric currents and ley lines. This repeated symbolism in certain places. And it does indeed have to do with what I call the Excalibur sword as a type. And I argue that Joan of Arc's sword was an Excalibur sword. It was of that type. I argue two possibilities. There is also the possibility that Joan of Arc's sword was Excalibur. Now, let's assume that Excalibur was a real sword, okay?
Yeah.
A lot of scholars have concluded that Arthur did exist in one form or another.
Okay.
Okay, now let's assume that the Excalibur sword existed. Her sword, when you read the descriptions, she was invincible in battle and all the same kind of stuff, you know, with Arthur. And shortly before she was captured, she quit carrying that sword. And when she was captured and put on trial, the English were the ones who captured her, and the English were the ones who were driving the tribunal. The tribunal, when you read the script, transcript of the tribunal, they were obsessed with her sword. You know, they asked her repeatedly, where is that sword? What did you do with your sword? She goes, oh, it's with my thing. They go, no, not that sword. You know the sword we're talking about. And she said, oh, that one, I gave it to my brothers. I don't know, whatever they did with my stuff. And it's clear when you read this that there was no way in hell she wanted that particular sword, her special sword, to get into the hands of the English. And it's pretty clear to me that the English wanted that sword. Now, ask yourself, you've got a sword that the description of it being carried into battle is pretty much, you know, identical to what's described about Excalibur as far as the carrier being invincible and all this stuff. And, you know, here's this French woman, girl carrying it. Of course they'd have an interest in this sword. It's part of their history, their lore. You know, they're curious.
They think it is.
Yeah, they think it is anyway. And that's all that matters is they have to think it is. Somebody in England, be it the crown, whoever, just has to think that it's Excalibur. And therefore, by God, we want that sword. Now, she got the sword because she would hear three voices of saints. Everybody, if you don't know the story of Joan of Arc, Wikipedia it, okay? read some books, watch a couple of the movies. She heard voices, one of whom my readers will be very familiar with, was St. Catherine of Alexandria. And we all know, readers of EOW, who St. Catherine of Alexandria was. She was actually the goddess Hecate. And I go into that with Rick Spence, and I go into that in the first Empire of the Wheel book. I'm not going to rehash that argument here. But St. Catherine of Alexandria, a.k.a. Hecate, is the one who specifically told Joan, according to her own historical testimony, to go to the Church of St. Catherine in Fierbois, and that the sword would be behind the altar. And she, you know, the sword was found.
Where Martel left it?
Where what?
Where Martel?
Where Martel had buried it, you know, some, what was it, 700 years before, I think?
Yeah. What? Yeah. Go ahead.
And
we're going to discuss how he got that sword, because I thought that was kind
of fascinating. Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that, too. And, in fact, that's next. So she gets the sword from Martel. Now, since you brought it up, we have to go back 700 years to how Martel got his hand on the sword. He, according to the legend, and according to the theory of a sword collector, oh my gosh, I didn't write his name down. It's in the book. If you could, I would love to credit him, because this guy, his theory is really amazing. You know, his account of what happened.
Go ahead with it. I'll find it.
Basically, they were Martel and his army were outnumbered, and the odds were against them. They were up against the greatest known cavalry and military in the world at that time, which were, excuse me, the Saracen army, the Muslim army that had, you know, occupation army that was looking to expand their territory in Europe. And he prayed for a miracle, prayed from help, some type of sign, and a meteorite burned across the sky and crashed out into the beyond the battlefield, and he took his blacksmith,
yes,
and his weaponsmith, and they all went out there, and they brought this the meteorite, nickel iron, whatever, the rock, into their camp, and the weaponsmith and the blacksmith worked all night forging him a new sword. Who this weapons expert?
I'm trying to find it.
Describes as a Damascus blade, which is a special way to make the sword. And Martell went before his guys with this new sword and said, "Look, this sword was sent by God from the sky." And they were victorious at Tours. You know, you study the history of that battle, and Martell,
Bernard, something Bernard.
Yes. What's the first name? Michael? Is it Michael or last name is Bernard? It's in the book, folks. I apologize. It's Michael, right?
I'm still looking. Go ahead.
So anyway, feeling victorious and grateful to God who sent this sword to him via the meteorite, Martell goes to this church in Faribois, which at the time I think was a chapel, and buries the sword behind the altar, gives it back to God, so to speak. To be used again, a la Excalibur, you know.
Lance Bernard.
I recommend his article on this whole thing about
Joan of Arc's
sword.
He tried to reproduce the sword.
Yeah, he wanted a copy of it, couldn't find a replica anywhere, so he wanted to reproduce it himself.
So he have it reproduced.
Yeah, and his research was amazing. Now, here's the thing that pinged in my mind. Oh, wow. What is a meteorite but a rock from the sky? Or a big boulder, or a stone, yeah. And what did his weaponsmith did? What did his weaponsmith do?
He made a sword out of the stone.
He drew a sword out of the stone, right? Yeah. Sword in the stone. And I thought, golly, you know, I Barney Fife there for a moment and said, you know, golly, did I figure something out about Arthurian symbolism there? Maybe Excalibur. What they were talking about was a weapon made from advanced. Metallurgical alloys and such, which in those days would have come from the meteorites. You know, a meteorite falls; it's like from God, right? To the Dark Ages mind, that's going to be something from God.
Yeah, I don't know how advanced it is; it's just iron and nickel and some other things.
Well, but the thing is, when they forge this sword,
it's
going to be
so strong
that it's just going to hack right through the crude iron.
Yeah.
And pig metal and stuff that, you know, the other guys were making their weapons from back then. And, of course, you know, things get exaggerated.
Yeah.
I go into some other aspects of Excalibur and the telluric currents and stuff like that, which I'll let you read in the book. You got to leave some stuff for the readers. And so, therefore, I went from Martell backwards to Excalibur because Martell had a sword that he got out of the stone, right? Excalibur was the sword in the stone, and Joan of Arc, if she had Martell's sword, it was a sword from a stone. And you have the English. Not only are they getting their butts beat by, you know, the armies that she leads, but they want that damn sword. It's a national symbol to them, at the very least, is what I argue in the book. Now, let's say that the sword also represents what, let's say, the alchemists of the day... You know, the advanced scientists of the day would understand, hey, wait a minute, this is an advanced technology, advanced metallurgy and such like that. We who would have been interested in that but the Knights Templar? So it would have been one of those things, we need to keep this, not just anybody can have this technology, in our opinion. And what were the Templars all about back then? They had been persecuted. They'd been out of favor for 100 years. They'd gone underground by the time of Joan of Arc. It's siren time.
The Radio Mysterioso siren.
Yep.
So you know we're live and legit.
That's right. So the book goes into the possibility or why it's possible that Joan of Arc's sword was secreted by her brothers into the hands of the Knights Templar and then brought to the Americas, which I also argue they had been established for about 100 years by then.
Who had?
the Knights Templar, according to the theory of the Templars in America. They would have been, if this is true, they would have, you know, been here since Prince Henry, Sinclair.
Sinclair?
Yeah.
From Scotland?
Scotland, yeah.
The hell was he doing over here?
Claiming new lands, which if you, when you read the thing about Oak Island, that blew me away too. When I got into the
all the oaks planted there, they weren't there because of
The oaks aren't indigenous.
Didn't skip
right. When I got into the actual history, remember, folks, I studied some mainstream history too to back these things up. And in mainstream history, when you study how the various European nations would claim possessions in the new land, that's a very interesting little part of history. The French would do it different from the Spanish, who would do it different from the English. And
it's cool. A sword made out of meteorite.
That's cool.
Partial meteorite. You know whose it is?
Whose?
Terry Pratchett, the novelist.
When he really? Got knighted, it's Pratchett's, huh?
When he got knighted, I just saw this because I was just like looking at this and listening. He's like, they what? Somebody had it? He went out when he got knighted and said, he said, I'm going to get some iron ore and some meteorite ore and have a friend of mine who's a blacksmith make it.
That's cool. Think about it. If you're knighted, you should have a sword.
Yes.
So
an Excalibur sword, yes.
So, yeah, so, you know, there, that's in the book, too. It talks about the, when you asked about evidence for, you know, the Templars being in America. The book goes into that, the whole Henry Sinclair thing, and that gets into the West for Night issue. But the Oak Island issue, here's the interesting thing. I don't think the money pit has anything to do with the Templars, but I do think Oak Island was the, you know, a Templar landing site, a Prince Henry landing site. And I get into that in the book.
Why would they care? Why would they come over here? Why wouldn't it just be him coming here as a Scottish nobleman instead of a Templar knight?
Because when you
there wasn't any difference?
Because when you...
Well, not any big, difference, but it was just as important to him.
There was a huge difference when that the answer to that is, if you know anything about what the Templars are about, that makes all the difference.
Well, what's any group about that wants to gain power and influence and land? And
Or that had already.
Yeah.
You know, now remember, they were suppressed by the time of Henry Sinclair.
Yes.
So they were all about, you know, keeping their heads on their bodies, on their necks, and also moving their holdings around. Here's the thing. Their treasure disappeared. Their fleet disappeared. David Childress has written an excellent book on that, by the way, about the Templar fleet and the subsequent age of piracy on the Atlantic and the Spanish Main, which, if you're interested in this stuff, you should read.
Wouldn't those ships have been really damned old by that point?
Greg, you are being way too literal.
Oh, I see what you mean. You mean a secret pirate, whatever.
A tradition that was started.
Okay.
The Templar fleet disappeared from La Rochelle, France, during the persecution.
Well, you know what it sounded like you said? Well, the fleet was disbanded, and then there's pirates. It's like...
I didn't say it exactly that way, but if you're a literalist, you could certainly interpret it that way. It resulted
People
in...
listen literally, Walter. You have to lead them away from the literal into what you're talking about.
They're really that far behind and that slow? I don't think so. I give people credit. When I listen to things, I don't listen literally, that literally. I'm able to...
Well, if I said something that was really obvious to me, it wasn't to you, would it mean that you were slow?
No, but I would just say, well, clarify. What do you mean by that?
All right. By saying, well, how did those ships survive, I guess I was saying clarify. You don't have to. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they you know, the fleet disappeared. Their treasure disappeared. Their tradition lived on just undercover. For instance, and this leads into Juan Cabrillo, when the Vatican and the King of France said, okay, all you leaders of Europe, arrest your Templars and shut down their orders and persecute them, put them in jail, you know, bring them to us, whatever, turn them in. There were some countries that said, fuck you, Pope. Fuck you, King of France. Portugal and Germany were two of those countries. And King Dennis I of Portugal said, here's what we're going to do. I hereby disband the order, the Templar order, and I hereby establish what's called the Order of Christ. All you Templars in Portugal, you're now in the Order of Christ. The order, the original Order of Christ was known to be a Templar sanctuary. And if you were one of the original Order of Christ knights, you were very probably a Templar. Which then gets into some interesting things when we get into the Age of Discovery in the Americas. Because there were more than a few of those guys that were Order of Christ knights. And therefore, potentially Templars when you look, you know, more closely at their lives. The fact that they could be makes it a very intriguing topic to look at. So, but here's the thing. The Templars knew about the New World, most likely, before they were persecuted. They were keeping it to themselves because of the resources. These were the guys that they had the maps. They had the ancient information from the ancient mariners. If you study Hapgood, if you read the most recent book by Joseph Farrell, the Janus Age, Hermes Trismegistus in the Janus Age, that one, the new one. And when you read the Financial Vipers of Venice and stuff, he gets into the Templar history and their possession of the Cardinals and the maps and their knowledge of the New World and all the evidence to support that. So they knew how to get here. They knew it was here. Where would you go if you were being persecuted all over Europe and you had to go somewhere where they couldn't get you? You'd come to the Americas. This was the obvious place to come to because they could have been found anywhere else they went. And this is the obvious place they would have brought their treasures. You know. And ironically, in spite of the fact that I argue they brought their treasures over here, I still say that for those interested in the money pit, that the money pit was not one of their places.
Carlos says the meteorites, the iron in meteorites is purer than that was produced by blacksmith in the 8th century. The nickel that exists in meteorites also strengthens the steel.
And in case we didn't get enough sirens.
Yes. The nickel that exists in the meteorites also strengthens the steel that the meteor would produce. And I wrote alloy. Yeah, you've basically got an alloy before people knew how to make alloys, which is why it was a little more miraculous.
And I also present in the book the 12 elements that are very interesting, that gets into round table symbology that might have been a clue to the ingredients for specifically the Excalibur sword. And again, that's something I'll leave for people to read in the book because it's very technical. But it has to do with some interesting elements and how they factor into the whole thing. So there's a little bit more technical considerations in my theory than just apocryphal tales. I do get into, you know, certain analyses of elements of the mystery, and literally elements from the periodic table of elements I'm speaking. To back up, or at least to present a consideration of my theory. Again, I can't convince anybody of anything. That's where I'm a literalist. I gave up. Around 2010 is when I pretty much gave up on most, not gave up on most people, but gave up on trying to convince people of anything. That's a game that can never really be won.
Well, it can't be won with any subject.
There you go. Thank you.
That's why.
There you go. But
that's why I don't have people on the show that I sit here and argue with for 2 hours. It's like, what's the point? What I do is I poke at them to see. You know, like I'm doing the same thing with you. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, what does this mean, Walter? Well, what if somebody says this? And that leads us to other things. I'm not trying to knock people down.
Right.
I'm just kind of
You don't do that. But you know, it's there's a lot of folks out there that they want to be convinced, or they think that. They need to convince people of their theories.
I don't care if I'm convinced. What I care about is people explaining things in a way to an audience or a reader or whoever that makes sense to them quickly enough so that they don't go, "Wah!" and go away. Mm-hmm.
This well, see, I've given up on the people that would even go, "Wah!" and go away. I think it's
a challenge. If I've got something that I want people to...
Really?
If they don't believe it, tough shit. But the thing is, if they can't get on board with me after I try to patiently explain something in the clearest language possible, then that's the point. I don't care. It's like, you know, somebody's like, you didn't mention this, so this is this. Like, yeah, yes, I did. You didn't read the book.
People that are that much of a challenge are not worth my time.
Hey, Carlos also said blacksmiths were often considered holy men by villagers.
Yeah, because they knew these secrets.
Yeah. I said like alchemists almost.
If you have to work that hard to convince a particular person, that particular person, for me personally, I'm speaking, that's not worth my time. I got too many other things to do, too much energy to be, you know, to be focused elsewhere than getting into a debate.
Well, that's
debate
why I don't argue with people
with
about
somebody.
UFOs. I don't. I was on a radio show the other, a national one, strangely enough.
Debate is not masturbation for me, like it is for so many.
Yeah. People. And I said, sure, I'll be on the show. No debates about Bill Moore, please. I'm sick of it.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing about master debaters. Sure, if somebody said, like, I can't wait to see what this everything I said is a load of crap thing is.
I was a little too literal with that. I mean, the guy was a lot more thoughtful than
well,
that.
Well, that sounds like something I responded to. See if I responded to it, because there is a guy that pointed out some stuff, and I did intelligently say, well, you got to look more closely because he overlooks some things.
It was a long post.
Yeah,
it was
a longer post, but
it was almost a too long didn't read.
I mean, if it was only 2 or 3 weeks ago, I might have missed it. But I mean, I'll respond to that because it's in writing, and I believe you should never let something like that go unanswered, even if you just answer it with a smile.
Yeah.
But to get into, you know, a lengthy debate with someone to try and or even hope to maybe I'll convince him. I don't see it
you
as a challenge.
Answered it yet.
I see it as a pain in the ass. Really? Okay. Who posted it?
Count Otto Black posted it. As racists go, H.P. Lovecraft wasn't one of the really bad ones. Seriously, how anti-Semitic can you be if you marry a Jew? It's apparent throughout his writings. He was basically paranoid about any group of people. He felt both to be alien to himself and part of what he considered to be the big, great big exclusive club he didn't belong to, etc. It goes on.
We're speaking, of course, about my proposal that Lovecraft poisoned the Houdinis
That
dinner in October, the month that Houdini died. And, of course, my book goes into much more detail than just...
Yeah.
You know, I present the anti-Semitic.
Okay, you would have answered this. Walter Bosley, you are a cynical liar.
Who's that?
Same guy.
Oh, Count Otto. Okay, anybody...
You've taken a conveniently long-dead celebrity whose character flaws did not in any way suggest that he might be a murderer.
Count Otto. Okay, Count.
Whatever his name is, that's the one he has on here.
Well, you know, at least my real name is... Walter Bosley, and I put it out there. I will deal with the Count later. With much humor and amusement, because clearly he's a Lovecraft fan.
Yeah, I got it.
And, you know, I expected this from the Lovecraft fans. In fact, I expected more of it. So thank you, Count, because you're the first Lovecraft fan that's emerged from the woodwork that has even looked at my stuff or listened to it and is bitching about it, but I will reply to you.
Somebody else said, I don't like when Walter talks about these books because it's boring. I like when you talk about the high strangeness stuff. We've mixed that in on this
show.
The
books are high strangeness. Jesus H.
They have elements of them.
Yes.
All through them.
Well, you know, but you got to remember, I'm also, by profession, I've been a criminal investigator, and the when I think there's the murder of innocent children involved, I kind of find that an interesting topic to discuss.
And then there's an equal amount of comments saying, oh, that was a great show, I really liked it, very interesting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, very long.
The people who do comment, they tend to enjoy, you know, when we discuss this stuff.
Yeah, well, nobody writes in and says... Eh, that was okay, I guess.
But
they either like it or they don't. Like it or don't.
Wait, did he say I'm a cynical liar?
Yes.
Wait. How can I be lying? I present in the book actual writings of H.P. Lovecraft. I'm not lying. I may be incorrect about my theory.
Made up a ridiculous scenario involving two celebrities who had no meaningful connection with each other and pretended that one had murdered the other because you wanted to make money.
Wait a minute.
And he's making tons of money.
Okay,
now
I'll deal with Count Chocula later. But, I hope he's listening. Anyway, back to the secret missions.
Well, the listener also said, no disrespect meant to Walter. I really prefer when you discuss High Strangers. But congrats on finishing the trilogy.
Same guy?
No, this is a different guy. Success to you, sir. Saying, I'm not really totally interested in this, but you're a cool guy and I like most of your stuff.
Well,
so,
you
know, that was, it's just a nice comment.
So, anyway. So then that leads to Juan Cabrillo, who basically, here's the thing in a nutshell that the book
gets
into.
Yes, let's get to the California connection.
I'm gonna state it in a nutshell, and I'll let the readers, read about the details. Here's what I argue. There is a mystery about Juan Cabrillo. Historians do not know anything about his birth, where he was born, or exactly the date. They know nothing. He's a cipher as far as his origin. He appears on the historical stage. He's already 19 or 20 years old, and he's already in the New World. He's in the army of Narvaez.
What should people know him for if they're not from California?
Juan Cabrillo is known for being the explorer sent by Spain to explore California, California.
Upper California.
North of Baja.
Right. Go ahead.
He's the first European to set foot in what is now San Diego and the Channel Islands and you name it, on up the California coast mainstream history says to the mouth of the Russian River. And the book goes into the whole nonsense that he missed and did not explore the San Francisco Bay twice. The book goes into why that I think that's a load of crap. But his death is also mysterious.
Yes.
And the book goes into the details regarding that. Well, here's my points on Cabrillo. I argue that it has long been said by many that Cabrillo was Portuguese. However, there was never any documented evidence. There was never any evidence found in Portugal to support it.
That he was Portuguese.
Or
Spanish.
And yet he could have been either or. Even his name, just everything about him just seems like he's a mystery man. Well, my research led me to conclude that he indeed was Portuguese, because others described him as such. And where could you be born? It was believed he was born sometime in 1500 or 1501. Where could you be born in this world, be Portuguese, but not be born in Portugal and not be born in Spain, which they also argued that he was born in Spain. And I learned that, Brazil. Pedro Alvarez Cabral had claimed Brazil in 1500 for Portugal and moved on. Now, the book goes into how Cabrillo and Cabral might have been connected, but I argue that Juan Cabrillo was born in Brazil. That answers the question of his Portuguese birth or, his Portuguese upbringing, his Portuguese identity, and why there's no record in Europe whatsoever of his birth, because he was born in the New World, the first year of Brazil as we know it. There wouldn't have been a record. Now, his death gets to be a little bit more interesting. In the book, I propose that the accounts of his death, of which there are multiple reported by the men on the expedition, are actually, this is what I propose, the man didn't die then. I argue that his death was faked, and he went on to live for however many X number of years. We don't know. He disappeared. At that point, the book goes way out on the branch of speculation as to why and where he went after that. But the details of his death are very mysterious. Here's the interesting thing. No remains, no gravesite, no bones, nothing have ever been found of Juan Cabrillo since.
Yeah, even in the place where he...
Yeah, and we're talking...
One of the Channel Islands.
We're talking 400 and some years.
Yeah.
Okay? They said that they buried him on Catalina Island. Here's the problem. In the story of his death, they're anchored off of what we call Catalina Island, and they send a fresh water party to go to the island, grab some fresh water. These guys don't even get off the beach. They're attacked by hostile natives. They're being slaughtered. So Cabrillo, according to the account, leads the rescue party
and he's injured during the rescue of them. They come back to the ship. His injuries are so bad. Remember, this is the middle 16th century. The medical technology, forget about it. You break a bone, you're going to die because of the gangrene, and you're in the new world on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, you're in the field. So he dies, and they get this. They bury him on the same island, according to the accounts. Now, I ask you, here's the logic of this. The freshwater party.
They just got attacked.
Yeah, the freshwater party didn't even make it off the beach. They're going to turn around a few weeks later, you know, where they haven't even been able to leave the ships and go on the island all this time because of the hostile natives. They're going to go back to this island, allegedly, and take the time to dig a grave, have a burial ceremony, fill the grave back in, and then go back to the ship when clearly they wouldn't do that on the beach because the remains would get washed away. Yeah. They would have to do it on a little bit more firm ground, which meant they'd have to go deeper from the beach. Well, the freshwater party that caused this whole tragedy didn't even get off the beach because of the hostile natives, and they could see the hostile natives from the ships. So the whole story of the burial doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, and they could have gone to another official island, record. I guess.
Well,
oh, but the story is they went back to the same island.
The story is they buried him on what we know as Catalina.
Yeah. Catalina's pretty big.
True.
Not too many places to land, though.
That's the thing. And they didn't talk about they moved the ships. They were anchored in the same place.
Yeah.
So here's the thing.
Probably in Avalon.
Might have been wherever
that's,
it was allegedly
that's a natural
supposed
harbor
to be.
And it's
but here's the thing:
the
since then, people have combed that island looking for these remains, and they haven't found them.
Yeah.
So now people would say, "Now, wait a minute. I'm sure when these guys got back, they told the details and the you know." Well, here's the problem: as soon as the expedition of the three ships got back to New Spain, they were immediately sent to Peru. The ships never returned, and the men weren't heard from again. Now, people today would say, wow, I smell a conspiracy there.
Or they disappeared because it was an incredibly dangerous thing to do.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And maybe the people that wanted these guys to disappear counted on that.
Yeah.
Think about it. It was an incredibly dangerous thing to do. It was an incredibly dangerous place to be, and it was also the easiest place in the world to murder somebody and get away with it. You're out in the field. You're
probably
out in
anywhere
the wilderness.
Outside of Europe would be easy to do
but,
that.
But particularly this frontier,
yeah.
Out in the middle of a jungle. Oops, an animal got him. Oh, my gosh. Oh, he fell down. Come on.
For what purpose? I mean, covering up the death.
Covering up the death, yeah.
For what purpose?
To cover up what Cabrillo was really doing, who he might have really been. I argue that he was a Knights Templar. And the book goes into the details as to what his death symbolizes. I won't go into that here.
I didn't get
people
got to
read
yet.
That. The book explains
meaning
why
something,
I think
the reason that
his
death
was
fake,
described the way it was.
Right. The reason his death was probably fake because he was doing something that where dead men tell no tales.
Exactly. Here's the thing. You got to remember, we don't know anything about this man the first 19 or 20 years of his life. Okay. The whole lifetime of being Juan Cabrillo, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, could have just been a mission. And when that mission was over,
yeah,
it was
now you're thinking like an evil government man.
Now here's the thing: some people say, but he had a wife and sons, and the record talks about his wife and sons. You got to remember, in the 16th century, a man who was a sailor or a soldier, his wife was used to the. He was gone for years at a time.
Yeah,
these women and these children understood that. Dad could go and never come back, and it could happen at any time, and it happened to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the, you know, what a mean man, what a terrible father. He wouldn't do that. The 21st century mind says a good daddy wouldn't do that. But back then, you know, a very respectable explorer.
That's right. He has them well taken care of, and then he goes off and does his stuff.
And they were well taken care of. Now, there was some dispute over, you know, more property they felt they had a right to, but they were well taken care of. I mean, he became a very rich man in Central America.
So after saying that Aaron Gullius is listening, saying, enjoying Walter's conversation, while I don't always fully understand his conclusions, his work is never less than interesting.
Well, the best way to understand my conclusions are to read the book.
Okay.
Remember, when I come on these shows, I'm not trying to make it to where people don't have to read the book. Yeah. I want people to read my book.
Well, then what was Cabrillo doing that they had to cover up?
Well, the book goes into his secret mission had to do with the Sword of Joan of Arc.
Why would he be bringing it over anywhere over here?
It was already over here. I point out in the book that it was in California at the time, and I argue that...
There we go.
I argue that that's how he ended up with the California expedition. And I suppose, this is speculation, I speculate that the Templar treasures were moved across the continent as the populations grew. And it finally reached a point where it had to be moved to its next spot. And Cabrillo might have played a role in being the custodian of the sword and taking it to its next spot and then spending perhaps the rest of his life being the custodian of that sword.
Why is it so important to have these treasures spread throughout the world on telluric nodes?
Because of the potential power, technological power. It goes back to why Hitler wanted the Spear of Destiny.
I was going
to
bring that
up. Whoever has the Ark, whoever carries the Ark before them has an invincible army. Whoever understands certain technologies. I mean, the reason that we debate whether
like blacksmiths.
The reason we debate whether there was advanced technology in the remote past is because it has been suppressed.
Yeah.
For mostly political reasons.
Yeah. When we say advanced technology, meaning technology that we think is advanced for that time, that does things that we don't understand how they work yet,
right.
They probably did work.
Right.
We don't have a whole hell of a lot of evidence for it, but we have a lot of indicators pointing in that direction.
Yes.
Not just for Cabrillo and the sword and all this, but a lot of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, for the topic in general, there are indicators,
that we suddenly think that everybody that came before us is a lot smarter. It has nothing to do with it. It was different.
Some of them were.
Maybe they were. They weren't. Well, then where are they if they were so smart?
Who says they're gone?
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone's mortal. I mean, my God, we're all going to die, okay?
No. I'm not talking about mortal. I'm talking about a society and a civilization.
See, now I was being literal like you with the ships.
Yeah.
Where are they? Things are cyclical, I mean, cataclysms hit, civilizations fall.
Right.
I mean, look what's happening to us right now. We are, take America. America's at its lowest point in its history, I think. Culture. Oh God, yeah. I'm not getting into this as a debate. Our culture right now is in the friggin' toilet. There's been hysterics since 9/11. Everything is fucked up beyond all possible imagination.
I think of the Bill Hicks thing. If you go out in the middle of the country, where is all this? You hear crickets, and people are just living. I will agree with you on certain in particulars. Everything is
civilization
getting worse.
The point is civilizations come and go for a variety of
reasons.
Exactly. So that's why these advanced guys, they came, they went, whatever the reason. We've risen.
Yeah.
We will go.
Yeah.
And 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years from now, somebody will say, well, where are those guys if they had F-16s and widescreen TV?
Once in a while, these things turn up. And we were talking about earlier. You know what's fascinating is that huge pyramid in, where is it, Serbia or something?
Yes.
The thing everybody thought was a mountain.
Yeah, I did work just down the road from there more than once.
Yeah?
And
but
I heard
did you ever
that.
See it? Oh, you heard about it?
No, heard about it while I was over there.
So it was something that people kind of knew about then.
Over there, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those hipster things where people that are around the thing know, and then about 20 years later, 100 years later,
some guy writes about it.
Yeah.
I was going to say some asshole writes about it. Here's the thing. It's like Marco Polo said. I haven't said half of what I've seen, I think that's the paraphrase of his quote. Sometime around, I think it was after I wrote the first book, I decided, or during writing the first book, that, okay, there's just going to be certain things I'm finding that I'm not going to put in these books, and I'm not going to talk about publicly. And that those are the things that changed my position on whether I give a damn about convincing anybody of anything.
Yeah.
Because there are certain things I've been convinced of. And you know what? It's not my responsibility duty like, to society. Yeah.
It's like somebody that sees a UFO and they say, well, I saw it could be something completely mundane, or it might be something that's truly unknown, or you saw a ghost, or you saw whatever.
But until
experience something anomalous, you're not going to see it the way that person does. And there's I don't think there's a there is not a place in the language for you to, unless they can have that reproduced for themselves exactly, there is not a place in the language for us to impart that experience to somebody else.
Yeah.
In our language, anyway. That's I don't know about other languages.
Well, it,
unfortunately,
I think there's some. Here's what I've encountered. Here's what my experiences, the conclusion that my personal experiences of the last 7 years have led me to, and all my life really, but in specifically,
yes, we've talked about this on the show extensively.
Is that certain information. Nobody owes it to the public to share with the public. The individual has to go out there on their own. If they want to, the individual, if they want to know certain things, it's their responsibility, certain things, to dig it out themselves. Neither I nor anyone else, I don't owe it to anyone else to share everything I've found or encountered. I don't care to convince everybody of everything I think or that I've concluded. I don't even care to convince everybody of what I've written about. I just present, and they can read it, and they can make their own decision. Count Chocula has decided that I'm a cynical liar. Okay, but I would argue that what's working him up, ruffling his feathers, is in Empire of the Wheel 3, I just simply present facts. Documented facts about H.P. Lovecraft. I'm an H.P. Lovecraft fan. We were talking before the show. This is the first year that I haven't gone to the Lovecraft Festival. I went 3 years in a row. I love H.P. Lovecraft. His works.
Yeah.
But even so, what I found out about the guy is he was a bit of a dick. And I'm sorry. When you look at his committed writings,
yeah,
he indeed was anti-Semitic. Now, did he hate Hindus and Asian? Of course, he hated a lot of people. But you can't say he wasn't anti-Semitic. He's trying to whitewash, a bastard. When you read what Lovecraft wrote about Jews, come on. I defy you to come away with a different conclusion than what is apparent by what he wrote.
It also makes him probably not much different than a lot of white Eastern, whatever.
Does that excuse US. Him?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't excuse.
And does it argue against the possible action that I say that he could have, might have? Does that negate that as a motivation for? No, it doesn't. Because so there were a lot of assholes.
Yeah,
there's some a of lot them, of assholes
yeah,
today.
Some of them, some of them wrote good fiction.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, wasn't H.L. Mencken a very respected writer of essays and author and stuff? And he was a complete jerk in person, they say.
Oh, no, he was a
satirist or something?
Yes. Yeah. But, oh, no, he was viciously satirical.
Yeah.
I mean, in his writing, too. Very, I mean, if his personality was just like his writing, it's probably almost impossible to get along with.
So,
but the thing is, we talk about this too, and I've talked about it with friends. Kubrick was a terrible person. It's hard to get along with him. Made incredibly great films.
Yeah.
It separate them from their personality. I'm just talking about the guy.
Oh, I can still enjoy Lovecraft's work.
Yes, exactly.
But when it comes down to the situation with Houdini, I presented, a speculation based on documented facts, just like I do with secret missions. I'll tell you, there's some people that are taking the books very seriously.
Carlos says, guilds were how knowledge were passed from one generation to generation, from generation to generation for thousands of years. Academics were considered untrustworthy because they were supported by the powerful elites.
What was the first part of that? I kind of missed
guilds that. Were guilds. How knowledge was passed.
Oh, yes. Yeah, we're going back to the metallurgists. Yeah.
Guilds have a new name these days, secret societies.
Well,
yes. If you're talking
to
about
a
group of people that have a common interest and band together to further that interest, yes.
I would say guilds can also be, universities, certain, you know, scientific organizations.
Yeah, well, I kind of argue
they behave like guilds now.
I'm almost, I think, in a certain way with the internet, I think they may be coming back.
Yeah.
Like a musical guild. Mm-hmm. Instead of a record company, have like, you know, 50 musicians banding together under whatever.
Can we find these guilds in the World of Warcraft? So anyway, I know for some people, the way you and I talk about these things, it sounds meandering, but
I don't care.
It's all just kind of a milieu. I present milieus. That's the way I look at it.
And, has anyone discovered a Templar vault yet?
As such, no, of course not. But
That was one of my questions. I was like, let's go back and see what I wrote down.
I mean, I argue that there was one inside Mount Rubidoux. I argue that you haven't got to that in the book. You
yes, I have.
Yeah, you should have got that. I argue that
I think you got a little weird in the South name, Mountain. But
well, I had to, you know, I had to.
You followed it to a.
Me, that was an, you know, an evidentiary thread that had to be pulled.
Yeah,
and it is interesting. There is some resonance there.
I guess so, but the fact that the guy had a piece of land there and they misspelled his name.
Changed the spelling.
They changed
the
spelling. But the thing is, they had that name to begin with just because the guy happened to be there.
But they changed the. You got to ask yourself, it wasn't a misspelling. It wasn't a misspelling. It was a purposeful change in the spelling. You're right. The name had been there. They knew what the actual. There were other federal agencies and state agencies using the proper spelling of the name, but they changed it. So I'd be curious to know.
Three sets of sirens. Yeah, this must be an important show.
That's right. This is a three-alarm show, folks. So, Count Chocula. Count Chocula, if you're listening, this is a three-alarm show. This one really ought to piss you off. A cynical liar. He doesn't know me if he thinks I'll do anything just to sell books.
Because if you did sell books, you'd be doing a lot better.
I'd be doing a lot better, and you'd see me doing a lot more of the conferences and the.
Yeah.
You'd see me at a table at every conference. You'd hear me on a lot more shows. I'd be begging and. You know, kissing ass to be on more shows and stuff. And
Walter, I think that's why we resonate with each other, because the way you describe what you're doing, I maybe that's how I feel. I gotten to the point where it's like I'm just going to talk to people I want to talk to and friends of mine, and yak on this show and do whatever. And if I get invited to a conference or whatever, well, that's how it was in the beginning. I didn't say I'm going to write books and talk at conferences, and people are going to, like, yell my name. It's like, no, I was just doing something because
And I'm
going to
make a lot of money. Yeah. Please. Good Lord.
Somebody
said, do
you want to write a book about this? And I went, huh? What? Really? Yeah.
I wish I was making the kind of money that, Dracula thinks I'm doing this for, because that would be nice.
Dracula.
It would be that makes him a cynical liar because he hasn't looked at the facts. There you go. There's a guy bitching at me about my presentation of facts who hasn't done his own homework.
I know what Walter's going to be doing when he gets home.
Oh, yeah. good thing the count is a night owl, you know.
I remember when I was being attacked on UFO Mystic, you actually came up and said, what the hell is your problem?
To the guy? Well, I'm sorry. There's some people.
Until I stopped answering him. After a while, I would, like, it took about 6 months for him to calm down and stop saying anything. At first I say, okay. That was my whole, like, reply. Okay. Or, that's nice. That's your opinion. And then he'd, like, 15 more paragraphs. Okay. And then finally, I just stopped even saying that.
Well, you know what's interesting is, it's like, wow, did something I said. Something I said or wrote, did it really, you know, poke somebody that deep in the eye? Wow. Cool. Yeah. You know?
Well, it did in a lot of cases in both of our experiences. Well, anybody, you know what? When you do something and you don't keep it to yourself, people are going to give you shit.
There you go. That's why, let me tell you, the stuff I'm keeping to myself, they don't want to hear. I mean, Secret Missions is essentially the
maybe
last
Howard
book.
Stern. What's one of them? Come on, Walter. Yeah.
Secret Missions is essentially the last book of this period.
Cycle?
Yeah, this cycle. So those who hate all those books will be glad to hear that.
My next work is going to be...
But I got stuff going on as a result of all that that's not in the books that, you know, really...
H.P. Lovecraft.
It comes down
to
nobody's friggin'
business. That's going
to
be your next.
Yeah, but let me put it to you this way. The stuff that I'm not talking about, if people wonder how I can be so confident with what I've written, think about what I just said. The reason I'm so confident with what I've written has a lot to do with the stuff I'm not talking about. And, of course, you heard it here first. The next criticism leveled at me is, oh, he's just saying that to intrigue people to sell books.
No, I think the reason you're saying it is because there are things that – there's things that happen to me and everybody that does anything that you'd rather not talk about because they keep you going. Or
they're convincing in some cases.
Yeah. But the thing is, if you brought them out, I don't think they'd be any more convincing. They'd be convincing to you.
Oh, they've convinced some others.
Oh?
Yeah.
Then what is the point of not convincing a greater audience?
Because I owe nothing that personal to the greater audience. Because, quite frankly, the greater audience might not be interested in certain things, you know.
Because when you talk about it, what I put it down to is there is no way I can explain this to somebody. I can explain it in the way that I have, and if you don't like it, that's too bad.
There you go. And that to tag on to what you just said, because you just went in the direction I was going to go. My audience is everybody who's bought my books,
and
enjoyed them and read them. All those people, and they are buying them, not by the hundreds or thousands.
Yeah.
But God bless them, they're out there. Now those people, I feel I owe something to, and what I owe to them, I've put into the books. And what I owe to them is my confidence that I'm, what I'm communicating about my confidence and a respect to them. Those people, any of those people that read the books and had a question, wanted me to clarify something, I would do my very best to further clarify something for them. But, you know, the ones who just, you know, for whatever reason, they don't like what I'm writing about. They're not interested in it. So they're just hypercritical and they haven't read the material and they're not going to read the material. Those are the people. And that's the greater majority of people out there that you're referring to. That's my interpretation. When you say, what about the greater audience? That's the greater audience. They're the ones who really aren't interested in what I'm doing. I don't owe them anything. They're not interested. So what do I owe them? But the people who have taken the time and are reading the books, those people, they come forth. I'll take however much time it takes with them to answer whatever questions, you know, respectfully. But because
everybody has a different, you know, Terry Pratchett has a reason why he writes what he writes.
Well, and people are better off.
Stephen King has a reason why he writes what he writes.
But there's certain truths in reality in this world, literally, that I could tell you about it all day long. You're not going to get it until you see for yourself and experience for yourself. And that goes beyond just, well, it's convincing to you. No. I'm talking about if you were to see it and experience, you'd be convinced. And anybody who sees – here's my argument. Anybody who sees or experiences this stuff that I'm referring to vaguely would be convinced. Anybody. They'd come away going, oh, crap. To the degree that they're a skeptic – it might be a bigger, oh my God, oh crap. Okay? Depending upon how open you are, how skeptical you are, any one of these things that I'm talking about, being vague about, any of these people were to see it, they'd go, or experience it, or learn about it, they'd go, oh crap. You know, there's something to this. Wow. Yeah. He's right. It isn't just subjective.
Yeah. Well, I can explain the same thing about spy stuff. It's like, why do you talk to those people? Because it's interesting. If you don't talk to them, you get nothing.
Well, you got to ignore these people that ask you, why do you associate with this or that? You do pretty good with politely telling them to take a hike. I mean, who the hell are they? Seriously, I'm addressing, you know, Greg or anyone else I know who who, you know, gripes or bitches about who he talks to or another host or another person. My question to you is out there, who the hell are you to be griping and bitching and worrying about something or somebody that interests Greg or anyone else? You know, why don't you go find your own interests? Why don't you question your own, you know, issues and contacts? I mean, I've heard this over the few years, and I've seen this in other situations, and I'm just asking myself, what's with these hypercritical people?
That's just player hate.
They got their panties in a bunch, and I think they like having their panties in a bunch. You know?
Oh, there's many people like that.
Yeah. I mean, good Lord. Or what was it? Some guy they saw when they were an impressionable junior high schooler who was a cynic, you know, smart-ass bastard, just really impressed them. They said, that's the way I'm going to be. It'll get me chicks and hits on dudes.
I don't know what the
stuff.
Thing is. There are people, I've talked about this before, that are professional outrage collectors.
Yeah. This sounds cheesy, but you know what I've gotten in the practice of asking myself? I ask myself, how would Cary Grant respond? You can tell I'm a 50-year-old classic movie fan, but I just say, how would, because, you know, I've read a couple of books about him, and he was just always Mr. Gracious, and, yes. And you know what? That goes a long way. James Spader. I want to share a James Spader.
Yes, because he always plays assholes, but...
He plays such great assholes.
Oh, God, yes.
He's finally playing a heroic prick, and that's Reddington, and I love that character.
On what?
The Blacklist. I know it's network TV, but
see,
God, I love it.
The last thing I saw him on was, what's that, whatever,
here's
the courtroom thing with William Shatner.
I read a Spader interview, and they were talking about, you know, the kind of guy he is, and he said this. He goes, there were many years of my life, I'm paraphrasing, there were many years of my life where I had to be right. And basically he's implying no matter where it hurt or whatever. And he says, I reached a point in my life where I realized I could either be right or I could be kind. I chose kind. And yeah, I read that last
after
year and I thought, you know what? That is a very good point.
Well,
he,
yeah.
He chose
he,
kind.
Yes. He could also evolve a little bit and consider the fact that he might not be right occasionally.
I think that was his point.
Okay.
I think that was his point. His point is he could argue, I'm right, you know, but it's like, you know what? Maybe I'm not always right, and maybe it's not so important to be
maybe
right.
It's not important to be a dick to this particular situation.
You know, in
just
any...
Just to prove a point.
So...
Did you ever see the one quote I have on my Facebook from William S. Burroughs?
No.
The mark of a basic shit is that he always has to be right. That's the only quote I have up there.
That's good. You know what? I did this recently.
I mean, and I'm going to conclude she, too.
I did this recently. There was this knucklehead on one of the other podcasts that I did an interview on for, and this guy just totally went off, you know, slinging venom at me and stuff. And I came back with, you know, I said, look, you know, you don't know me. You haven't. I did it right. I kept the high ground. While also nicking him a little bit with the Cyrano dagger, you know,
yes.
doing it eloquently.
Yes.
And the host
That's
came
how
back.
You should do it.
When the host came back and saw it, he removed what the guy said. He says, I apologize, blah, blah, blah. But I was glad that the way I responded was rather than, and I could have laid into the guy.
Yeah.
He just set himself up for a slicing. But I didn't. And so, you know, it's that because people need to embrace civility.
Yes.
One thing, like this show, for people who've never heard this show before and have like read my books and are coming here to, you know, because of that, Greg and I talk very casually because we've known each other a few years.
I talk very casually to just about anybody.
Yeah, you do it all the time on this show, but that's
even
why if they're listening to
people.
This interview, the meandering nature, it's not like other shows where it's a little more structured and Greg and we like it that way. You know, Greg
yes.
likes it that way. You know, that's the way
Walter
he's always
was
done
here
the show.
For much of the development of this show for years.
But on the issue of civility, now, in my personal time in my home when I'm talking to the dog or laughing with friends or something, if I want to talk like a sailor, I can.
Yes.
But I even cringe a little bit when I think that I've just used colorful language, even here, which is okay because it's a podcast. And, you know, when we want to be curmudgeonly and throw out, you know, like this. And
yeah, that's fine. Whatever. I don't mind swearing. I just don't like gratuitous anything or uncivil discussion.
Right.
If somebody's getting nasty, I'm like, eh.
But I find myself thinking, I hope I haven't turned anyone off because, you know, I often, 99% of the time, start out promoting something on your show. So the first interview they hear is the one where we're goofing around, like the most casual. And sometimes I think, okay, are they going to bother? Are they going to be turned off and not listen to the more structured ones that are more formal? And, you know, I'm being Mr. Nice Guy, you know. But that's just in my head. But that
it is just in your head. Don't worry about it.
It goes to serve what I'm talking about, civility and, you know, what would Cary Grant do?
Tops maybe audience of 2,000 or 3,000 people.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, but you know what?
Don't care.
There could be for me, there could be that one person listening to me who's some nice old lady or something who he sounds like a big jerk, you know, and then unfortunately I've lost.
Forget it.
You know me, I'm not losing sleep over this. It's one of those things while I'm on the subject kind of thing.
No, so. I know exactly what you're saying, and I feel the same way. So. And I try to be civil with people, and if I can't, then I shut it off. And look what came in the mail the other day.
Oops. Oh, cool. A Kachina ring.
It is a little Kachina ring. It's about an inch and a half tall and about a half inch wide. It is a Fred Harvey era ring.
Okay.
Meaning?
What, 50s?
20s.
Wow. That's cool.
And they redid the shank for it because it was too small, and they actually made it, they actually antiqued it and put little dimples in it to make it look like it was from the period.
That's cool.
So, yeah. That's
very nice.
Yeah.
Is it any particular Kachina, or is it just like generic Kachina?
It might be a particular one. I'd have to look it up. I have a guide.
How many
the reason
do you
I
have
like
now?
It is because it doesn't look. How many Kachinas I have?
Yeah.
25.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Not a lot.
The reason you like the ring is because it doesn't what?
Because it looks like it was made, and it was, made in an era where they didn't know what people wanted. So they just did anything.
Yes.
Now things are very.
Creativity.
Yeah. You look in the case, and we went to a jewelry store in Santa Fe. I looked at all the tribal people in Santa Fe. They have the blankets out there, and on the weekend they sell stuff. And, they have to get a license from the government, and they have to be from the tribe, and all their stuff is beautiful, and it all looks the same.
Yeah.
Because they're producing for an audience now. At this point, 1920s, when the tourism was just starting, large-scale tourism was just starting in the Southwest, they just did anything that they thought people would like.
That was evocative in their minds.
And this is one of them. And it's not even solid. It's like pieces of hammered silver.
Yeah.
But it's
almost
a relief.
Like scrap.
Yeah.
That he took little pieces. And
that patina on it is because it's, almost 100 years old.
That is so cool.
They did a really nice job with putting the new shank ring thing on it. Anyway. I wanted to show that to Walter because he's one of the few people that actually appreciate it.
That's a lot cooler than the plastic tomahawks I used to get at the roadside trading posts on Highway Route 66 when I was a kid.
Yeah, the only thing left that's good. What's Stuckey's, because they sell black velvet paintings and fireworks.
Stuckey's, good old Stuck and pecan logs. Nut logs.
Yeah, nut logs.
Nut logs.
Pecan and Minnetonka love. Moccasins.
Hey, before I forget, speaking of evocative, as I said, I just recently published my first fiction in a while. I'm spending.
When was that? You now are officially turn around, and there's another book guy. It's not Nick anymore.
I've done three. I've published three books in 3 months.
What do you do all day?
Here's
right?
the thing. Here's the thing. The novels are actually already in rough draft.
Yeah,
I'm able to create the final draft and get it out there in about 3 weeks. But these are.
Do you have anybody read your things before you?
I have 7 that are in rough draft.
Yeah.
I had 8. I just published one, House of Ka. People are digging it. Do I have people read it? Nah. Here's how I do these things. It's in true pulp tradition.
Because I am totally
I'm cranking it out.
I'm totally paranoid after I did my first book that was David did it.
Yeah.
Oh. But all he did was provide the publishing.
Legendarily no editing there.
Yeah. But the thing is, I did the editing along with my wife at the time and one other person that I paid. I actually paid my wife to read the whole thing and proofread it. And there were tons of mistakes, and there's still tons of mistakes, and I'm mortified every time I see them.
But you know what? How many people really care?
A few people have actually said on Amazon, okay, too bad people. about the typos.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a whole other show.
They don't say
show.
This book sucks because of the typos.
Well, some people do. Nah. Some people do, but for the most part, yeah. It's.
Oh, you know what pisses me off? People that can't spell or use proper grammar. Even if it's like, well, how do you know? They could be real smart. And I say, no, they can't, because they can't spell or use proper grammar.
Oh, you mean like the people that leave their comments?
Well, either that or
somebody. Or writers.
Right? I mean, people are paid to do blogs and stuff, and I read them. I was like, what the? Did they even think about what they're writing?
Particularly in manuscripts, because there is spell and grammar checks.
Yes.
For those who are
challenged. Anyway, we're off the subject. Go ahead.
Oh, anyway, House of Ka. you know, it's been out for 2 days. It's already gotten a couple of 5-star reviews.
Yeah.
I'm getting good notices. What I do is, you know, I take the rough draft and I'm finally getting to this stuff. It's stuff that I've written since 2005.
Yeah.
While I was doing the films, before I even discovered the Empire of the Wheel stuff, and during the Empire of the Wheel era, I was writing these rough drafts of these stories. And so finally, with all this nonfiction phase for now, I'm through this cycle, I guess you'd say. I'm focusing on the fiction, and I'm just going to get all these rough drafts and final and get them out there. They are all pulp stories. They're all mystical, esoteric, detective-type stuff. The one I'm writing now, writing the final draft of now, is going to be the October release for the Halloween season. It's a spooky, Hammer pulp type of thing.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there's one of these that's kind of like the old Executioner or Mac Bolan men's action kind of things. Yeah. There's going to be one of those. There is also, but they're all written in the pulp tradition. They're all
I hunted Nazis less than in 200 a beatnik hootenanny. I hunted renegade Nazis in a beatnik hootenanny.
There well, we in the House of Ka, there's a librarian that works at what is ostensibly the Smiley Library in Redlands. There's this Vava Voom librarian who a couple of the guys, when they read it, they said, God, I love the librarian.
And I'm married to one, so.
So it's a lot of fun. But, yeah, these are all written in pulp tradition, so I want to keep them at under 200 pages each.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just having a blast. I'm bringing my magazine back. But I'm focusing for the next year. I mean, I'll be doing interviews on the nonfiction, the Empire of the Wheel series and the Secret Mission book. But as far as writing, my focus is going to be on the fiction.
Damn it, Walter, how do you write fiction? I keep trying to do it, and I don't like it.
It's easier than you think.
Yeah.
I'll
have to buy you a beer.
If you like fiction, if you enjoy stories, I have a little...
I don't usually.
Do you like movies?
Yeah.
Well, then, if you like movies, you should be able to write novels.
Yeah, I have not read a novel in a long time.
Mm. Neither have I. I hardly read any fiction. The only fiction I've been reading, I just finished a pulp from 1958 called Murder in Barakoa, and now I'm reading something called The Low End of Nowhere, written in 1996. God, who's the author?
That is a great title.
The Low End. Oh, it's a great friggin' book. It's a mystery featuring this character named Streeter. And damn, I apologize. I can't think of the author's name, but I'm reading it right now. The Low End of Nowhere. It takes place in Denver, the Denver area. Damn good book, written in just a great pulp language style.
Yeah.
It's awesome. You know, so I've read very little fiction in the last several years, but I've written, you know, screenplays and I write fiction. I reach that point where I find other fiction creatively not distracting, but I don't want to say a waste of time, because there are other, obviously there's other authors I will read. You know what, I prefer reading authors I know personally. Bill Craig, I highly recommend anybody who likes pulp detective stuff and adventure stuff. Bill Craig, you've got to read this guy if you like This guy, he is one of the best. Mike Mott, the guy who does the research on caverns, he writes great pulp. Sword and Sorcery Adventure Pulp. He's helping me again with Lost Continent Library Magazine, which will be coming out again in May after, 5 years now?
You know, go ahead.
And there's a guy, a writer that I've just become acquainted with, Alan Whitlock, and I want to read his stuff. But what I'm saying is writers who I meet and can become acquainted with personally, these are the writers I want to read the most because they're flesh and blood people to me. Hmm. For, you know, after I met Ray Bradbury and had me and a buddy had just a personal conversation with him at a conference years ago for about 20 minutes, I actually enjoyed Bradbury's writings more. You know, I wrote a letter to him, got a reply when I was in college.
And, wow.
And his writing became more alive to me because I met the man.
Yeah, you know, I never met Burroughs, but I've got hours of him talking.
Yeah.
Now when I read his stuff, I can hear his voice when I'm reading it.
It's kind of like by proxy. You feel like, you know, you've met him. And it just makes someone's writing more alive. And actually, you know, it kind of, yeah, it does kind of make you less critical in a cold way. Because, you know, writing is not easy. Creative writing anyway is not easy. And those who have the balls to do it, you know, I give them credit for trying. I give anybody credit for trying something.
Ooh, let me...
That's how you can appreciate Ed Wood films. Good God. The heart and the effort. You know.
I'm going to read like probably like less than a minute of this. Mm-hmm. You tell me who you think that, well, you would never know. I wouldn't either. The Day the Mummy Returned. Have you heard about this one?
No.
It's from the collection Blood Spatters Quickly. From the Cloudy Skies.
It sounds familiar, but go ahead.
From the cloudy skies, far across the snow-covered mountain ranges, far from the ocean's roar, where the sun beats its torture on desert sands and the pyramids nestle near the guarding sphinx, lays the tomb of the pharaohs. She of the golden hair has only fallen to the ground in a deep faint. 3,000 years have passed since I was placed here in my tomb to remain forever. Now infidels tear away the sands of endless time. They break the great doors of my tomb. They enter the very vault of my final rest.
Is that Lovecraft writing for Houdini? Is it?
No.
Mm-hmm.
That is Ed Wood.
It's Ed! Count Chocula is going to love that. I just compared Ed Wood to Lovecraft.
he wrote a lot of pulpy, crappy fiction. And Red Pill, who has been on the show a couple of times, I should have him on again. Pointed this out to me, that there is a collection called Blood Splatters Quickly, a collection of Edward D. Wood's fiction. And on Boing Boing, I think they had one of, they posted one of the stories.
Oh, that's got to be some interesting stuff. I will add that.
And when I started reading it, and then I started slipping into Criswell, because I read this and I think it's Criswell reading it.
Well, imagine, he probably, I wonder if he would have Criswell read his books aloud as a proofreader.
Yeah, probably. Now, read that imagine to me there. That. Yeah, read that to me, Cris.
I would like to emphasize, too, anybody who reads my pulp fiction that I write, it is truly pulpy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in that new pulp era. Stories, my themes are, this isn't Disney stuff.
Yeah.
So.
No, I wouldn't think so. Before we go, since it's 5 after, Walter brought me a beautiful poster.
Oh. Tell them.
Yes. Let me put this in the holder here so I can open the poster. You've been saving this for me for like a couple of months?
Mm-hmm.
The Alien Reproduction Vehicle Blueprint poster.
I accompanied a couple of people, one of whom is Joseph Farrell. And another guy, we drove up to the...
I'll put a picture of it up when I post the show.
Yeah, we went to San Mateo, where Joseph was speaking at the Breakaway Civilization and Secret Space Program conference in late June. A lot of great speakers at this thing. And I saw that they were selling this poster. Said, Greg's got to have this because he's got a poster of all the UFOs throughout the years that is
from
kind
1958.
Of in the same, yeah, from 58, and this is a perfect accompaniment to it.
Yeah, well, when
style.
I get a man cave, or you know what this might replace is the elements relating to the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, June whatever or whatever it was, 1968, that I have on my wall right now. You've seen that, right?
Yes.
It's a blueprint.
Yes.
Of where everybody was standing during the Kennedy assassination. It's one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen. Only surpassed possibly by this. The cutaway illustration shown here represents details witnessed directly by three civilians and corroborated by four military officials. A photograph taken in 1967, available from retired Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens' UFO photo archives, matches the size, the external details of this craft. Anyway, it's an alien reproduction vehicle.
The ARV.
Yes.
I'm and sure several of your listeners are familiar with this schematic.
It is a beautiful drawing.
Yeah,
done by Mark McCandlish in March 1989.
Yeah, he spoke at the conference.
Oh, okay, so he was selling these.
Mm-hmm.
Mark E. McCandlish, M-E-M.
He spoke at it. Michael Schratt, Robert Morningstar, John Rappaport, Catherine Austin Fitz, Carol Rosen, who is the one, of course, who Wernher von Braun told about. You know, first it will be terrorism, then it will be a trumped-up alien threat and all this stuff. Joseph, of course, spoke. And you know what I really enjoyed? And I might have mentioned this to you. I don't know if I did on the air, but what I really enjoyed about it was at one point the guys running the show brought, was it Bassett? One of the disclosure gurus up there. It was just really irritating as all hell. And he realized quickly that it was a mistake because the disclosure mania has nothing to do with what this conference is all about. And it kind of, you know, for an hour there, kind of was discrediting the event. And fortunately, the next day, they nipped that in the bud. And, you know, this was a really interesting event, an awesome event of intelligent people, you know, speaking and attending. And it's
cynical.
What's that?
I'm getting so cynical. I don't feel like I would have had any fun at the thing, but
really?
I didn't go.
Oh, you would have.
Yeah?
Yeah, there was interesting. We had a lot of fun at the motel. Dolan spoke there, and I mean, we had a lot of fun. Rappaport, John Rappaport, you got to have him on the show. He's the funniest guy. Oh, my God. He had us in stitches after hours.
Well, see, the thing is he has to do that on the show. See, Peter... Peter Robbins did that at one of the crash retrieval conferences.
Yeah.
We were sitting out in the lobby. I told this story before. We were sitting out in the lobby just having drinks at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't Laughlin. Where did they have him? They had him in Henderson.
Yeah.
And he started telling stories. And by the time he finished his first story, there was a crowd of like 20 people around us. And then the second story, there were 50 people around us. And there were just people that were wandering through the casino.
And those are the reasons to go to these things. It's those.
And he wasn't telling UFO stories. He was telling stories about stuff that had happened to him.
When
I had him on the show one time, I said, Peter, all we're going to talk about is you're going to tell the stories that you told him. And he did.
When you talk to Rappaport, the Lyra story, the Italian Lyra story.
Oh, okay.
It's just short. It's just brief. But his delivery, we were dying. That was the thing that had
us laughing. That's what Peter's like. He has this perfect way of of telling a story so that you're just
now,
screaming
that's a writer.
With laughter.
I wish that I had that type of gift and then I could just translate it into onto the page.
His setup stuff and the way he uses just describes stuff is...
You got to have Rappaport on the show.
Okay.
I am a strong advocate of that. And
hey, John, my friend Walter told me, and I used to listen to you a long time ago on Roy Tuckman's show in KPFK in the 1980s when I worked in video post. And he told me you're really funny. I mean, apart from the health news stuff that you used to do, you tell funny stories. So let's just do that.
Yeah, exactly. he'll do it gladly. So
anyway, look for secret missions. The Hidden Legacy of Old California. It's going to be available print on demand soon. I was writing a novel, so I got to get back to
but you can
prepping
Kindle
the manuscript.
It right now.
But to Kindle it right now, And it's proving to be so far as popular with the people who like me, with my readers,
it's
as the EOW books. It's I think it's $4.99.
Oh my God,
$4.99 or five? It's something like that. It's all my stuff.
Walter,
is
you're
well
never
under...
going to get you cynical liar. You're never going to get rich doing that.
Yeah, I know. I'm a cynical liar, just trying to make money. But I my books, my novels are 99 cents, folks. My fiction, I write novels and I sell them for 99 cents to stay in the pulp tradition. But you know what? I've sold more at a buck a piece.
Yeah.
Than I ever did or would. Trying to price them like the
See,
real
well, you
writers.
Are. You are so, a money-grubbing cynical.
Because I want people to read my stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
And I like to see it move. I mean, yes, you know, Chocula, I am a capitalist. Good God, come on. That's not a dirty word to me, folks. You know? But, so yeah, House of Ka is the one that's out there, the new pulp novel, just released a couple days ago. 99 cents on Kindle. It, too, will be available in print on demand soon. And there's another one that'll probably be out in about a month, which I'll reveal the title after House of Ka's been out a while. I don't want to confuse people.
Well, then I'll buy House of Ka. For what, 99 cents?
99 cents.
Oh, my God.
And for 99 cents, you can deal with a couple of glitchy errors.
Yes.
Oh, Bill Craig pointed one out to me that has to do with a gun. I have a gun... change calibers. not really, because technically I called something
a Walter is Ed Wood. He's got Ed Wood running through his veins and probably 800 other things.
I referred to a .38 Beretta. I meant .380. I left the zero off, and a .380 is essentially, you know, like a 9, and then later it's a 9mm. So the bullets will fit. Well, you know what it was? I explained to Bill. You know what it is, Bill? He carried the Cheetah earlier. It's a smaller gun, but he needed more accuracy. So the gun he went home to get was the 92F with the inch, you know, a little bit longer barrel for more accuracy. That's how I covered my error, but I kind of went, oops. You know, so anyway, thanks again for having me on.
Well, I have not seen you, I think, since the last time you were on.
Since early June, when I released EOW3, I think.
I almost flew out to Redlands the other day, but it was Saturday, and it was too cloudy.
Oh, I hope we have more days like that. Good God.
I could not get away from the Chino Airport because it was clouded
everywhere.
I mean,
I hate that you couldn't get out there by air.
I was going to call you and say, Walter, I'm going to be there in 10 minutes. Go out to the Redlands Airport.
I want it's dropping. I want a chilly Halloween. I'm tired of these August Halloweens.
I want a cold and breezy Halloween.
I don't know about Halloween.
I'll have to look at the Farmer's Almanac short version, but they're usually pretty accurate. And I don't know what they said about the end of the month. They said the middle of the month would be rainy for a while and then cool and clear ending around the 13th or so. I didn't look at the last. They do it in half months, I think.
That's encouraging because for the last several years, it seems like our October's
have been Halloween's always hot.
Hot.
On the 31st, bang, it gets cold. Or the 1st.
Yeah. I remember
it's
when
like
we
somebody
were kids,
throws
though.
A switch.
Halloween, by the time we got to Halloween, it wasn't hot. California's California. Southern California's Southern California.
It was cool. I lived in
but
San
I don't
Diego
remember
at that
it being
time.
Hot and yeah. sweaty and sunny on friggin' Halloween. I just don't
I don't know
that.
If I remember that either. It just seems like that's what it's been doing for the last few years. Global warming, Walter. See, you're denied. Oh.
Global warming is a natural cyclical condition. You know, it has to do with solar sun cycles.
Okay, well, we'll get you on with somebody that's done, like, you know, a zillion times more research than you. I don't know if it's true or not, Walter. I tend to believe that it is. You know what? And even if it isn't, it's probably a good idea to stop burning the fossil fuels. Because
we're going to run out of new technologies. But you know, I'll believe
as
anything.
My dad says about the nuclear power. It's like you have a choice. You can either have the possibility of maybe being irradiated, or the certainty of being parboiled by having too much CO2 in the atmosphere.
You know, it is convincing. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio. You know, anything he says, it must be right. But new movie out. I want to see called Interstellar.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, I hope it sticks to the message that you see in the trailer. I hope it doesn't, you know, Hollywood us and, you know.
You hope it doesn't Hollywood us?
Yeah.
From
like,
a movie
like
that comes from Hollywood?
Like Michael Caine says in the trailer, he says, who says that, you know, the Earth was intended to survive. We got to get off planet. We got to go. And I love that idea because I think that's the nature of humanity. We're nomads. We move from world to world. And yeah. when this world's used up, it's time to go to the next one.
It doesn't.
Now, don't get me wrong, people. It doesn't mean we should be a-holes and crap in our own backyard and be crappy. You know, yeah. we should treat our home nicely and stuff. But, you know, I like that idea that's stated. Now, when I say
like
Hollywood
that get mad about terraforming worlds, how can you do that to Mars? It's like.
Hollywoodist, meaning
planet.
I hope they don't end the movie by, you know, that character says, well, I guess I'm wrong. There's no place like home. And it's just a big nesting, you know, circle jerk. I you know, it's.
No, well, that's another Burroughs thing. One of his phrases is we're here to go, meaning we're supposed to leave.
I like that. We're here to go. I like that. We're here to go.
Yes. Devo actually has a song based on that quote called We Are Here to Go.
Wow. That is an excellent.
Yeah, I've got him quote. Speaking about that. He goes, "This is a space age. We're here to go. So let's get going."
Yeah, we are behind. Yeah. We've been pussyfooting.
Yeah,
as far as we know, read Empire of the Wheel 2, people. Count right. Chocula. You specifically.
You keep calling him Count Chocula. That's
you great. Read Empire of the Wheel 2, buddy.
He's
it's
not
for
gonna
you.
Read it.
I'll buy it for him. I'll send it to him free if he wants to.
I know. I used to have people like that would get mad at me about the magazine, and I would just say, here, I'll send you a free copy.
Yeah. Kill him with kindness.
Well, I'm not even trying to kill him with kindness. It's just like, I can either be mad at you, or I can just say, here you go.
Yeah, go
and
on
then
with life.
Have a good feeling about at least...
Yeah, for your end.
Yeah, from my end, saying, okay, I've done what I can. What did I pick up recently that you might be interested in?
Hopefully not a venereal disease.
Yeah.
I hope that got a laugh somewhere.
Somewhere. I can hear him screaming in down there on Facebook.
Yeah, it got a lump, a laugh out near, where's that, Nevada?
Laughlin? No. Laughlin.
The folk history of America is the history of its heroes. Big working men like John Henry, Paul Bunyan, and Big Bad John. But today I'd like to introduce a new folk hero. He didn't work in a mine or on a railroad or any of those strenuous occupations. He worked in a beauty salon, and his name was Bruce. Well, every day at the salon you can see him arrive. He stood 6'6", weighed 105. He's kind of narrow in the shoulders, narrow in the hips. A curl in his hair and a smile on his lips. Big Bruce.
Oh my God. I thought Walter would like this.
Big Bad Bruce. No one seems to know where Bruce came from. He kind of swished into town and stayed all alone. Never said much, kind of quiet and shy, and when he spoke at all, it was just to say hi, Big Bruce. Oh
my God, how many people are we offending
Big
right now?
Big Bad Bruce.
I don't care if they're offended. If they're offended, there's something
Some
wrong with them.
Some say he came from New Orleans, where he had a social group called the Cajun Queens. Some say Hollywood or Beverly Hills, where he got arrested for passing $3 bills. That's Bruce.
Oh, that's bad.
Then came the day of that terrible fire. Something went wrong in the number 5 dryer. Into the chaos of those matronly dames went Big Bad Bruce, so just a fan in the flames. Big Bruce. Big Bad Brucey Woosey. Well, the flames grew higher and the fire got worse. And someone heard Brucey cry, Mercy, I forgot my purse. Into the fire with a squeal and a shout. We waited an hour, but he never came out. Poor Bruce. Poor old Bruce. Where that salon once stood, a grocery store, but his name will live forevermore
in the annals of time and in the hall of fame as a gay young cat who went down in flames. Big Bruce. You might say this has been kind of a fairy tale.
I thought Walter might like that.
Oh, man. My sister's got to hear that since she owns a salon.
Yes. Well, I'll send it to you. All right. The next book comes out in a couple weeks, so you'll be back then, right?
In about, yeah. Well, I don't know if you want to talk about my fiction.
We'll talk about the fiction, but then the other thing we'll do is just play songs like Big Bruce.
Oh, maybe I can. Are you going to do the Halloween show?
Yes, I think so.
Well, maybe I can make it. You know,
if I'm here, you know why? Because Halloween's. Halloween is on a Friday. I don't know if I want to do it the Sunday before because it's my birthday.
Oh, that's. Yes.
I might do it post Halloween.
Well, are there any Halloween things on that night, on a Friday night, we could do after the show? Or you could do the show from your house, and then we're right there.
Could.
Closer to the fun. I
could do that.
The last time I was in the Hollywood area on Halloween, I think it was it when you were speaking at a UFO conference? Was it on there was a Halloween party going, Hollywood Halloween?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the National UFO conference that Lisa Davis had partially supported.
Yeah, I got to go up to the VIP room with you and talk with Dean Haglund and all the other people. And then, of course, there was some party going on. And my goodness, the...
That was the infamous Whitley Strieber dinner, too, that I got to go to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, but my goodness, the costumes that were walking around. Good Lord.
And we saw the cramps
walking
through
the... Young ladies are going to catch a death of cold.
Yeah, we saw Lux and Ivy walking through the... one of the hallways of the convention. I don't know if they were going to it. I don't think they did. The Cramps, the band.
Oh, okay. The Cramps, yeah.
Yeah, we were just sitting there, and Sigrid said, "My God, that's the Cramps." They walked right by us.
The things you see in Hollywood.
Yes.
On Halloween.
And now I think Lux is dead. The book is Secret Missions, The Hidden History of California. Mm-hmm. Yes. So check that out at Amazon as well as the House of Ka.
House of Ka, 99 cents. Dedicated to Count Otto Black.
All right. Oh, is this Purple Haze any good? I think it is.
So I guess all the Ramones are dead now, right?
Yes. Uh-oh. How come Purple Haze ain't playing?
It's like an Arab kind of thing.
I think so, or Eastern Europe. Let's just play the Queen medley, and you recognize it. Let's just play the Japanese Queen medley. Everybody liked that last week, and we'll tear down to this. It's all in Japanese. They just jump around because it's a medley.
Somebody needs to do.
So that, so that.
だ見逃してくれ何万だろうな見逃せまへん見逃せまへん
僕乗りたいな僕の自転車自転車自転車僕乗りたいな僕の自転車に僕乗りたいな僕のに僕乗りたいな僕の自転車にどこでも好きなところで黒いや白ホエロいや亀サメちょいちょいさんやめろよ俺はジョーズもスターウォーズも嫌いだよロールスいやロイス選ばせろ主要いやキリストピーターパンもフランケンシュタインもスーパーマンも僕は信じない自転車自転車自転車僕乗りたいな僕の自転車自転車上等な発泡酒をおしゃれなタンスに入れといたりケーキでも加えしとけばなんてまるでマリアントワネケネディの正体もフルシチョフのそれもも欲ってよ備えばなチョウザメの卵とタバコお上品な仕草もうほんとすげえ彼女は殺し屋上下空間で爆弾上手な光線中に男を一チコロおすすめするで寝かしてくれないかもよその気になったかでもそれは楽ではない調子のいい船旅でもない言うなれば挑戦だミスミスパリオさらすわけにはいかねえ勝ち進むのさずっとずっとずっと